When what happened was that Imam Hussein alayhi salam takes the 6 months old infant and asks for a drink of water. Just imagine the heat in the land of Karbala, the amount of thirst that all the members of his family had been experiencing in that scorching heat in that desert. And specifically, it was so hard to bear seeing an infant whose mother's milk was no longer there because of the thirst that also she has experienced. And they could do nothing for this little baby. So Imam takes him to the enemy, asking for just a drop of water. Especially, I'm talking about in that sense that he was passing his last moments of life, and the answer, the response of the enemy was to throw an arrow with three heads to the tender throat of Ali Asghar, alayhi salam. So that is why every year, even I remember with my own daughter, when she was really small, she was less than 1 year old, I took her to the session that all these moms gather, and witnessing that that beautiful, tragic scene would make the event of Ashura more tangible for you. Of course, again, this is considered among the black pages of history, and with it comes the white page. And to that, the white page is, what was the message behind the event of Ashura? Why was he forced to take part in this event? And it's a chance for all of us to reconsider ourselves, reconsider our values, our lifestyle, and to, you know, to constantly be re-evaluating and evaluating ourselves and our paths in life. May we train ourselves, may we educate ourselves and our families in a way that we would be sincere, honest soldiers in the camp of the last Imam of our time, Imam Mahdi. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala hasten his reappearance. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Oh my child, oh my child.
I am Brother Yasser Ibrahim. I am from South Africa, and this is my experiences of the morning ceremonies for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. I, alhamdulillah, have had the opportunity to see ceremonies in South Africa. I've had the opportunity to see them in England, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, in Iraq, in Australia. Something that I remember quite frankly, first of all, for me as somebody who's coming from a background that did not really truly understand that this kind of event, coming from a background that was obviously not as a follower of the Ahlul Bayt, going to England the first time, experiencing it, seeing that, okay, why are people coming here? Why are they crying? What is this all about? That actually led me to my own personal journey towards finding the truth. Why was this not told to us? Why were we not spoken about? For I remember quite, you know, clearly and frankly that when we were in school, that we were told that the Islamic governance after Imam Hassan alayhi salam, which was for 6 months, kind of stopped, and there was no khilafah after that. And so we were not told about all of this. One of the first things that struck me is that, what is this? Then obviously we have the cultural things that occurred in England. The United Kingdom, we see that people are from migrant background, India, Pakistan, and they come with their own styles. And what was fascinating is that when I was in England, it began to change. That obviously you have second, third generation Shia and Muslims who were born in that country. They wanted things to be spoken about in English, the majalis to be in English, the masaib or the actual story to be told in English. And this is what happened during that particular time until we are today, where majority of the actual sentence actually mention it in English. South Africa is no different. South Africa, because the lack of migrants, you have a growth from within. So it is right now a kind of culture that is being built. One thing that I found really fascinating in South Africa was that I have a friend or somebody who I know. He was Christian. Majority of the Shia in South Africa were actually Christians who became Shia afterwards. He was a Christian and he used to be in the choir, the church choir. And he would recite the poetry of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in the local language, and it was very beautiful because he had that church tone to it, you know, that singing tone to it. It was very beautiful. And one thing that in South Africa that is beginning to occur now is that the local languages are starting also to get some attention. It's not only English they're trying to target and trying to give other people the message of Imam Hussein al-Islam in their own local languages, which is something of extreme importance. Another thing that should be mentioned as a final point is that we should not, you know, judge every single country on how they mourn Imam Hussein. As long as you're doing it in the proper way within the laws of the divine law of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, do not say that mine is better than yours or this one is better than this.
Hello everyone, my name is Dara from the United States, and what I have to say about Muharram in Karbala, it's in America, it's very interesting because you have the opportunity to see different cultures, different people from different backgrounds, converts, you Arabs, Pakistani Indians, or Desis, Iranians, Iraqis. So it's very interesting, and most of the communities over there and the centers are different people from different backgrounds. They gathered there, and in time of Muharram is such a way that there's so many programs going on that you don't want to lose the opportunity. You want to be in every center, and a lot of programs are going, and a lot of the ulamas or the Islamic leaders, the traveling to different centers. Also, there's a procession going, and people go to the procession, New York, Los Angeles, and the big city to do the matams in Night of Muharram to show their respect to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And beside all these things, and one movement started in Europe and America, is the name Who is Hussein? And this movement is a very interesting movement that technically it brought the revolution of Imam Hussein to the social justice. So you start talking about who is Hussein in such a way that giving food and water to the people, and they create the opportunity to start a dialogue about Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And this was one of the things that people were doing in that time. As people love the Latmiyas, and a lot of people, they take the same tone of the matam in, for example, Iranian Arabic, and they try to recite it with English. There's a lot of programs that during the Muharram happens, and it's just the main important thing, I think, is the unity. This is one of the things, because people from all over different backgrounds, they gather together in one place for the same thing, for the love of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And you see how people sacrifice and during that time their love and everything toward each other. And you see the most, you see in the same time, you see the chaotic events is going on, and you just remembering Imam Hussein, people are in tears, but in the same time you see harmony, you see peace, you see you feel strength, your power, because you are with your brothers and sisters. And that's, it's something that I think, so that's a minimum thing we really can talk about it.
So there was this year that we were commemorating Imam Hussein alayhi salam in one of the Southeast Asian countries, and they had this whole huge sound system, their amplifiers and their microphones and their speakers, and we were saying Hussein, Hussein, and though there were guards around, no one really told us to keep it down, simmer down, don't yell too much, don't make too much noise. But this moment I remember distinctly is from the noon of Ashura. After 10 nights of saying Hussein Hussein into the microphone and amplifying it into the neighborhood to an extent, it was Salat al-Dhuhr. It was the noon prayers. And after the Latmiyat, the person, he, while the crowd was saying Hussein Hussein and beating their chest, he decided to give out the call of the Adhan. He said, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. He said, Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah. And the moment he wanted to say, Ashhadu anna Aliyan Waliullah.
Ashhadu anna
That made my heart die instantaneously at that very moment. But then when years passed, I looked back and I thought to myself that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is what's going to save us and this nation. We still live in a time that we cannot yell Imam Ali's name off the rooftops, but Hussein ibn Ali, the son of Ali, is the power, the source, the glue that's going to bring our hearts closer. Because verily, إِنَّ فِي قَتْلِ الْحُسَيْنِ حَرَارَةٌ لَنْ تَبْرَدَ أَبَدًا. Verily, in the death of Hussein lies a fire that will never cool down.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Imagine you're living in one of the most impoverished countries in the world. You have no job, money, insurance, health system, clean water, nothing. And you don't know from where or when your next meal will come. Imagine your country is torn apart as a result of a bloody war, and the enemy is viciously targeting all civilian infrastructure, including the national grid. Without electricity, your country will regress to an age of darkness. The wheels of industry will come to a halt. Hospitals won't function properly, and everyday life will become a living hell. If you are in Yemen, you don't need to imagine yourself in all these horrible situations. You're already part of this human tragedy. Among endless problems induced by the war, long hours of power outages have created an invisible pain that runs through the whole country. The power cuts reach 8 hours a day, sometimes reaching 24 hours. It's like hell. We cannot sleep because of the high heat. We are living and dying in the dark. These are common sentences that can be heard in Yemenis' everyday conversation.
When you see that they attack electricity stations, power lines, power stations as well, and also blockade the oil industry and the oil imports that is so necessary for the fuel for the electricity production in Yemen. The one of the major reasons behind this is that they want to break Yemen's spirit. These are attacks that no longer target military goods, military or equipment or soldiers of the Yemeni Republic.
Power outages have left almost all major cities in the dark since the onset of the war in 2015. The Saudi-led coalition has destroyed many transmission lines, power stations, and other electricity facilities, crippling the country's critical center. Yemen's Ministry of Electricity says the coalition has targeted more than 5,000 power stations and other pieces of critical energy infrastructure, most of them away from any fighting or military site. According to the ministry, 90% of the total Yemeni population are living without electricity.
There have been several reports already that there are a lot of health centers. Some reports speak about the majority of health centers and hospitals in Yemen having shut down due to a lack of power and due to a lack of fuel necessary to fuel their generators. And the same goes for institutions such as oxygen factories that produce necessary oxygen tanks and oxygen machinery and equipment in order to keep people alive during life-saving surgery.
In April 2016, Saudi warplanes destroyed the main power station in Taiz province. 4 months later, in August, they dropped bombs on two generating stations at Harad and Midi in Haja province. 8 bombs also targeted the main power station in Amran, destroying 2 transformers. The coalition had already bombed in July 2015 a compound housing employees of a power plant and their families, killing and injuring more than 300. Some families have reportedly pulled their children out of school to fetch water as electric pumps have become useless. And those students who still go to school cannot study without electricity when night comes. Needless to say, the surface water children and women fetch is often contaminated with cholera and other bacteria.
You have to bear in mind that take away a nation's electricity and you make them drop back decades, if not centuries, into the past. And whereas, of course, you can say, you know, in the past people survived as well, the sudden drawback, the sudden collapse that the sudden cutting of all power causes will immediately, and in the course of weeks and months even more, cause a mass amount of civilian deaths. This is basically unavoidable if you take such a drastic step as to cut off an entire nation's power for an extended period of time.
Meanwhile, a handful of factories that have survived the war are now closed down in the absence of electricity. Long-lasting power outages have been taking their toll on Yemeni patients whose lives are dependent on life-saving facilities.
When lengthy power outages occur and the emergency backup generators may not always cut the hits and may not always be enough to keep the power running for a long time in places such as hospitals, emergency centers, childcare services, factories that produce necessary medical and other equipment. So this has had a very intense direct result for thousands of people in Yemen who are suffering from medical conditions, people who have been wounded due to the bombings, for example, that Saudi Arabia has been carrying out in Yemen for years now.
Yemen's Public Electricity Corporation has estimated that the financial damage from these measured attacks on power infrastructure adds up to over $4 billion.
When they seek to destroy Yemen completely, this is their way of indeed reducing the country back to ashes and then later on come back with a few billions of petrodollars to build up the country back as a Saudi puppet state and then portray the money that they gave as an act of charity. This is a very typical Saudi strategy that we have seen in this region in particular.
Yemeni citizens now have to pay a monthly subscription fee of up to 350 to 400 Yemeni riyals to private sector producers. Many Yemeni families cannot afford it. Before the war, it was just 7 Yemeni rials per kilowatt. Years of indiscriminate airstrikes and bombardments have destroyed the national grid and contaminated large areas across Yemen, including areas through which power lines pass, turning them into fields full of mines and unexploded bombs. In the words of Abdul Qadir Motahar, Director General of Transportation at the Electricity Corporation, "We have 490 electric towers in the Sana'a Marib line that passes through now, most of which are now destroyed or affected by the raids, shelling, and unexploded ordnance."
The blame for Western countries goes much further than merely selling weapons. Of course, when you sell weapons, I mean, my native country of Belgium has recently ceased selling weapons directly to much of the Saudi military, but not all, I believe. But before that, the Belgian government always said, like, we sell these weapons to the Saudis. What they do with it afterwards is not exactly our fault. You know, that is, they try to kind of turn around a little bit and shift the blame away that way. But the blame goes much further than that, especially in countries like the United Kingdom and the United States. They don't just sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, but they are directly involved in intelligence services. There are American and British forces and Israeli forces and experts directly present in the war rooms of the Saudi-led coalition.
The Yemeni Executive Mine Action Center says the dense amount of mines and unexploded ordnance that are now spread near electric transmission lines is huge. It'll take a long time before teams are able to reach them to start the rebuilding process. It is clear that a poor country like Yemen, which cannot secure even the basic staples of life, cannot get rid of these huge amounts of unexploded remnants and landmines in the near future. With the help of Ansarullah, Yemeni citizens have just started using solar energy. But the question is, will the Saudi-led coalition allow them to use it for a long time? And will light overcome darkness in the end?
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Today, we're going to talk about gambling, but before dealing with the issues and the laws concerning gambling, according to Ayatollah Sistani, let's take a listen to a short biography about him.
Born
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, in the last episode, we talked about, in fact, the position of Ayatollah Sistani. In fact, we began talking about the laws related to gambling. And you also mentioned the reason why these religious authorities, in fact, based their opinion, their religious opinions or laws on. And you talked about or mentioned three Quranic verses. Of course, along with lots of traditions and prophetic narrations, which are available to support their idea, right?
Yes.
We all know when you talked about khamr and maisir. Khamr, in fact, refers to any kind of drink, just for the lack of
intoxicants.
Intoxicants. Yes, any kind of drink that
makes wine,
a person or an individual drunk.
Alcohol,
right?
Alcohol. Yes.
Well, this is just for the, you know, clarity of the audience and those people who wanted to know more about what khamr is. But what about maisir? Do we have any kind of clarifying definition of what maisir is? Any kind of game of chance, as you mentioned, in fact, in the last episode? Well, can it be differentiated from the kind of, for example, games which are like computer games that are played today?
Well, the word maisir has been translated as game of chance, okay? Game of chance.
Yes.
If you play a game and there's a chance that you might win something and you might even lose it, so it's called a game of chance.
Yes.
Gambling or anything in which there is betting, okay? Betting. If there's no betting, then it's not a considered game of chance, okay?
Right.
And maisir is characterized by this feature. When there is a chance of winning something, anything of monetary value, anything of like money, like anything that can be of some value in common sense, in common view. So that can be a game of chance. It includes like gambling, backgammon, card games,
chess,
of course, and
pool games.
Yes, dominoes and so on and so forth. Yes, mm-hmm. There could be new games coming to the market. Okay, and as we have like PUBG. Even if PUBG is not, though it's not used for gambling,
mm-hmm.
but it can still be used.
Yes,
for gambling, if there are two people or three people playing this game from different places, from different cities, because this is an online game, and of course it's installed on your computer or maybe on your mobile phone.
Mm-hmm.
You play it with someone and you just play it for money, okay?
Right.
You either end up losing money or maybe you either end up winning money. So this game can also be used for gambling, mm-hmm. for betting.
Yes.
If it is used for gambling or for betting, or if it involves betting, then it's not actually permissible to play it.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
I ask these questions because some of the audience might justify, in fact, some of their games that they play, either for betting, for example, on something or not. In fact, and they may come up with some kind of excuses, such as, for example, the dimension of time or place. They say, for example, at the time of the revelation of these Quranic verses or the prophetic traditions, in fact, the meaning of these specific terminologies were different from now.
Mm-hmm.
So they say that, for example, this kind of game that I'm playing today is completely different. I mean, like, essentially different from the kind of game of chance which you mentioned, for example, by referring to those prophetic traditions as well as the Quranic verses.
Yes. I would like to say that we have to see at a game, generally speaking, if a game involves betting,
mm-hmm.
and if it is known in common sense or in the eye of custom,
yes.
as a means for gambling, even though it's not used for gambling mm-hmm. any longer,
right.
then it's not permissible to play it. But okay, there are some games like chess, like backgammon, which used to be considered as a means for gambling in the past,
mm-hmm.
but maybe they are not considered to be means for gambling today.
Yes.
But since there are specific traditions from the Holy Prophet and from the Imams, those traditions cannot be put aside and cannot be overlooked. So we have to pay attention to those traditions, and if we heed those traditions, pay heed to those traditions, we cannot start allowing, or the ground religious authorities cannot start allowing this, because according to this, to those traditions, mm-hmm. playing chess is forbidden under all circumstances, no matter what the reason. Okay.
What about horse racing?
That's something else. Uh-huh. That's something else.
Even if they bet on the horses.
Yes, of course. Horse racing is permissible. And of course, it is an exception. Muslims can take part in horse racing, and they can achieve readiness for competitions like this. And you can actually generalize it to make it a little bit broader, and in modern time we have like car race, we have other forms of competitions in which you see Muslims take part in order to get more preparation for any possible scenarios of hostility.
Yes, I asked this question because of, you can see the availability of, for example, horse racing and betting on the horses in many cultures, such as England, for example.
Yes.
or in some Arabic countries you may see horse racing going on. So what is it so special about the horse racing that made it different from other kinds of games?
You know, in the past people used horses to take part in a battle. The battle was going on between Muslims and non-Muslims. Okay, if Muslims did not know how to ride a horse or how to handle a horse while fighting their enemies, that would result in their defeat. So the smarter you are, the more prepared you are, the better it is for Muslims. Now, it's not only about horse race. You can say shooting competition is also permissible, even if it involves betting. Okay, and of course, it is permissible for those people who are directly involved in horse race. Now, if someone is just an onlooker, if someone is just a spectator,
yes,
he is not doing anything. He is just sitting and watching other people riding horses or maybe taking part in shooting competition, that person cannot bet on the teams playing or on the horse riders who are directly involved in horse riding, okay, horse racing. So he cannot bet. In modern time, we see that there are some people who bet on teams playing football. Like, for example, we have Barcelona, Real Madrid. Yes.
The clubs.
And there are betting, teams. There are people who are betting and there are... There is a group of people who bet on another group of people.
Yes.
And of course, if their favorite team...
This is unlawful.
It's not permissible.
As long as they are betting on an individual horse or horse racer, there's no problem.
As long as a person himself directly takes part in a competition,
yes,
there's not a problem. But if you are not related to the competition and you are just an spectator who could be a very indifferent spectator, you have nothing to do with the horse rider. And you are just betting with someone just to win some kind of money from your friend, because you can guess more correctly and more precisely. So that money that you are going to earn is not allowed. It's not permissible.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Majal ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Sami'un Basir
about you. IRIB English Radio.
Lecture.
شيخ طاهر رضا جعفر
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. We are continuing with our discussion on الخطبة القاسعة, the beautiful sermon of أمير المؤمنين علي بن أبي طالب. اللهم صل على محمد. The
The part of the khutbah that we have today can be summarized into the following points. The first is that whenever human beings, especially those who are Muslims and those who have submitted to Allah Azza wa Jal, whenever they experience arrogance or pride, then it is because of shaitan that they experience that. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam says, وَإِنَّمَا تِلْكَ الْحَمِيَّةِ. Verily that vanity and that pride, when it enters a Muslim, it is مِنْ خَطَرَاتِ الشَّيْطَانِ وَنَخَوَاتِهِ وَنَزَغَاتِهِ وَنَفَثَاتِهِ. When a Muslim experiences pride and vanity, it is because of the work of shaitan, the whisperings of shaitan, the temptations of shaitan. That is the first point. That when we, if we in our lives as believers ever feel proud, ever feel vain, ever feel that we are better than others, it is because of the influence of shaitan. And the second point is that Amir al-Mu'mineen tells us that we should fight now back. We should fight shaitan and this temptation to be arrogant using what? Using humility, using humbleness. He says, فَاتَّخِذُوا التَّوَاضُعَ مَسْلَحَةً بَيْنَكُمْ وَبَيْنَ عَدُوِّكُمْ إِبْلِيسُ وَجُنُودِهِ. Take tawadu, humility, humbleness, to be your weapon, so that you can use that weapon to fight against your enemy, shaitan, and his soldiers. So in order to fight shaitan, the weapon that we need is the weapon of humbleness. That is the second point. The third point, which is very dangerous, he says, فَإِنَّ لَهُ فِي كُلِّ أُمَّةٍ جُنُودًا وَأَعْوَانًا. Verily, shaitan has in every community soldiers and helpers. In every community in this world, shaitan has his soldiers and his helpers. That is the third point. And the fourth point is where Amir al-Mu'mineen mentions the story of Qabil and how Qabil was filled with jealousy for his brother Habil. And jealousy resulted from arrogance. He said, look how it is that when Qabil had arrogance in him, that arrogance led to jealousy, and what happened after that. فَلَا تَكُونُوا كَالْمُتَكَبِّرِ عَلَى ابْنِ أُمِّهِ. The Imam says, then therefore do not be like that one who was mutakabbir, who was arrogant, who was heavy-handed against the son of his mother, meaning his brother. Here the Imam does not take the name of Qabil, but this is the story of Qabil that he is mentioning here. And he says that it is due to the hasad that Qabil had that he killed his brother. And because he killed his brother, now he is the one who will be punished for any killing that is done on earth after him. Because he is the first person who instituted this act of murder. Therefore, any murder that happens in this dunya, part of the punishment goes to Qabil. And finally, the Imam says that look at the past nations. Look at the bygone nations. They all suffered this same problem and this same disease of arrogance, of vanity. Learn from the history of those who came before you. Why? Because تَشَابَهَتِ الْقُلُوبُ. The hearts of people are the same, are similar. Those who lived 1,000 years ago and those who live today, they suffer from the same diseases of the soul. If they had a problem with jealousy, if they had a problem with arrogance, we have a problem with arrogance. That is something that has happened throughout the ages to all the nations. So learn from the history that when people were arrogant, what happened to them? When they were jealous of each other, what happened to them? Learn from the history. And so these 5 points therefore summarize this part of the sermon. Sallu ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. So therefore we derive these themes from this part of the sermon. Theme number one is the theme of the importance of humility, of humbleness. Why? Because the Imam says that now humility is your weapon against shaitan. You want to fight shaitan, humbleness is your weapon. And if you look at those who are true scholars, those who are the great scholars from our history and the school of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, we find that they were very humble people, and they are very humble people. There is one great scholar in Qom, his name is Ayatollah Ja'far Subhani, well-known personality, he has many books. His student was my teacher. And one day in the class, he was telling us about how humble Ayatollah Subhani is. He says, I have studied with him for many years, and for a brief period of time, I did not attend his lessons. I was not well, so I did not attend his classes. One day, there was a knock at my door. And you know, they have this intercom system there where you can pick up the intercom inside and ask who is at the door. And the person will tell you, who is it? Nani. And they'll tell you, okay, this person has come. So my teacher says, I picked up the intercom and I asked, who is it? And I heard the reply, Subhani. So I thought for a second, who is Subhani? I don't know any Subhani. Because in his mind, this is Ayatollah Ja'far Subhani. But he calls himself simply Subhani. So humble, he calls himself, I am Subhani. My teacher, for a moment, he was taken aback. When he opened the door, he found it is Ayatollah Ja'far Subhani. Humility, humbleness. And this is there in many of the scholars. And that is why, when we look at the advice of Luqman to his son, and this is something very beautiful, huh? Each and every one of us who have children should read Suratul Luqman and see how he converses with his son. And he gives him advice, and beautiful advice. One of the things Luqman tells his son, he says, وَلَا تُصَعِّرْ خَدَّكَ لِلنَّاسِ وَلَا تَمْشِ فِي الْأَرْضِ مَرَحًا إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يُحِبُّ كُلَّ مُخْتَالٍ فَخُورٍ. Oh my son, do not raise your nose and walk with your nose in the heavens, meaning boastfully. And do not be arrogant on this earth. Don't walk boastfully on this earth. Why? Because Allah does not like those who are arrogant. This is one of his advices. So humbleness and humility is so important. What are the signs of humility? How do you know whether you are humble or whether a person is humble? Everyone claims, I am humble. What are the signs? We ask our fifth Imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi. He says, if you have these three qualities, you are mutawadi. Number one, you sit wherever there is place. Number two, you do salam to everyone you meet. And number three, when you have an argument, you give up the argument, even if you are right. This is tawadu. So that is the first theme that we have taken from this part of the sermon, the importance of humility and humbleness as a weapon against shaitan. The second theme that we take from this, which is very important and very dangerous as we mentioned, is as Amirul Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, as he says that فَإِنَّ لَهُ فِي كُلِّ أُمَّةٍ جُنُودًا وَأَعْوَانًا. Indeed, shaitan has soldiers and helpers in every community. That means in our community as well. And the ulama say these are not jinnat we are talking about, these are human beings. There are some human beings in every community who are soldiers of shaitan, who are helpers of shaitan. This is very dangerous. We need to look at ourselves. Na'udhu billah that we would play this role of helping shaitan. No. And we find, as we mentioned yesterday, what is it that these people do? What is it that shaitan loves? The first and foremost thing is to cause disunity, is to fracture the community, is to cause disunity between husband and wife. As we know from the story of Harut and Marut, وَيَتَعَلَّمُونَ مِنْهُمَا مَا يُفَرِّقُ بَيْنَ الْمَرْءِ وَزَوْجِهِ. They learned the magic of separating husband from wife. And that is one of the very dangerous things. When if you ever have somebody in the community who plays the role of actually causing separation in families. Separation. We as believers have to play the role of uniting. If we find at any time there are problems, it is natural, sometimes there are problems, we should try and help to patch things up. That is the role of believers. Not the opposite. When you move outside the household, you come into the society between believers. Shaitan loves to cause disunity, enmity between believers. لا يزال إبليس فرحا ما احتجر المسلمان. Iblis is continuously happy as long as two believers are not seeing eye to eye. As long as two believers are not getting along, he's very happy. And so, if you see anybody in the community causing these kinds of rifts, you know that this person belongs to that group that helps shaitan. Whereas our duty is to do the opposite, to bring them together. If you see any two mu'mineen who are quarreling, you bring them together. That bringing them together is known as Islahu Dhat al-Bayn. And the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, إِصْلَاحُ ذَاتِ الْبَيْنِ أَفْضَلُ مِنْ عَامَّةِ الصَّلَاةِ وَالصِّيَامِ. Bringing the mu'mineen back together when they are quarreling, patching things up between them is better than all the prayers and fasting. It is so important. It is so important. This is the value of Islahu Dhat al-Bayn. And so we find that there are certain elements in the community that work for shaitan. One of the things, as we mentioned, is to try and cause disunity. But there are other things as well. Our eighth Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Ridha, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi. He says, لَيْسَ مِنَّا مَنْ غَشَّ مُؤْمِنًا أَوْ ضَرَّهُ أَوْ مَا كَرَهُ. Whoever cheats a believer, or whoever harms a believer, or whoever plots against a believer is not from us. These are other examples of satanic traits. Working hard against mu'mineen. If you work against a mu'min, then you are helping shaitan. Because shaitan, as we said yesterday, doesn't sleep. He is constantly working against mu'mineen. However, now it is important for us to think about this, and we should not now start suspecting one another. Oh, you said that there are some shayateen in our community. Oh, I think that one. No, Baba, this is not the case. When we mention this, it is for everybody to look at themselves, not at others. Huh? Don't look at anyone else. Look at yourself. Don't look at anyone else. Allah Azza wa Jal is Sattarul Uyub. He hides the faults of people. Don't start looking for the faults of people and then say, no, this is min a'wani shaitan. No, 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 no. That is not correct.
Salli ala Muhammad. Salli ala Muhammad. Salli ala Muhammad. Salli ala Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل
The beautiful story that we have all heard, but it is so beautiful, so we will hear it again, inshallah, is about Musa alayhi salam praying for rain. When he prays for rain and Allah Azza wa Jal does not send the rain, and Musa alayhi salam is worried, he says, Ya Allah, why have you not sent the rain? Allah Azza wa Jal says, there is one person in this crowd who has sinned against me for 40 years. So Musa alayhi salam announces, and with the power of Allah, his voice reaches all the thousands of people who had gathered. He said, there is one person amongst you who has sinned against Allah for 40 years. Let that person leave this gathering and then the rain will come. Now that person knew himself. But he thought to himself, if I stand up, nobody else is standing up. If I stand up, everybody will know that I am the one who has sinned for 40 years. So he prays to Allah in his heart, Oh Allah, please forgive me. Suddenly it starts raining. Musa alayhi salam says, Oh Allah, nobody has left the gathering. You have sent the rain. Allah Azza wa Jal says, I've forgiven that man. He sought forgiveness, I've forgiven him. Musa alayhi salam says, Oh Allah, tell me who was he? Who was he? Allah Azza wa Jal says, Oh Musa, when he was a sinner against me, I did not tell you who he was. Now I have forgiven him. You want me to tell you who he was? Allah is Sattarul Uyub. We know that there are some in the community who are helping shaitan. But that does not mean we go looking for them. Rather, what it means is we should protect ourselves so that we should not be amongst these helpers of shaitan. The third part, the third theme that we can learn from this part of the sermon is the theme of jealousy, the bane of jealousy. As we mentioned, Amirul Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi. He mentions the story of Habil and Qabil in this part of the sermon. He says, وَلَا تَكُونُوا كَالْمُتَكَبِّرِ عَلَى ابْنِ أُمِّهِ. Do not be like the one who was mutakabbir on the son of his mother. He's referring to Qabil. And we know from the Holy Quran in Surah Al-Ma'idah, the story has been mentioned. Surah Al-Ma'idah verse 27 and 28, the Holy Prophet is told, وَاتْلُ عَلَيْهِمْ نَبَأَ ابْنَيْ آدَمَ بِالْحَقِّ إِذْ قَرَّبَا قُرْبَانًا فَتُقُبِّلَ مِنْ أَحَدِهِمَا وَلَمْ يُتَقَبَّلْ مِنَ الْآخَرِ قَالَ لَأَقْتُلَنَّكَ قَالَ إِنَّمَا يَتَقَبَّلُ اللَّهُ مِنَ الْمُتَّقِينَ لَئِنْ بَسَطْتَ إِلَيَّ يَدَكَ لِتَقْتُلَنِي مَا أَنَا بِبَاسِطٍ إِلَيْكَ يدي لِأَقْتُلَكَ إِنِّي أَخَافُ اللَّهَ رَبَّ الْعَالَمِينَ. O Prophet, tell them the story of these two sons of Adam. When they offered the qurbani, the sacrifice, Allah accepted from one and he did not accept from the other. The other whose qurbani was not accepted was Qabil, and the one whose qurbani was accepted was Habil. And when Qabil saw that his sacrifice is not accepted, in that rage of jealousy that Amirul Mu'mineen tells us is from his arrogance, his arrogance led to his hasad, and that hasad led him to come and tell his brother, I will kill you. The rage of jealousy led him to tell his brother, I will kill you. Habil responded and said, I have not done anything. Rather, Allah accepts only from the muttaqeen. If you had given your sacrifice with taqwa, if you had given your sacrifice correctly, Allah would have accepted from you. And then he says something very interesting, that if you extend your hand to kill me, I will not extend my hand to kill you. لَإِن بَسَطَّ إِلَيَّ يَدَكَ لِتَقْتُلَنِي. If you extend your hand to kill me, I am not going to do the same. Why? إِنِّي أَخَافُ اللَّهَ رَبَّ الْعَالَمِينَ. I fear Allah. Now just a side note before we continue, the Mufassirin say, how is it possible? Isn't it wajib to defend your life? Somebody wants to kill you, they are coming to attack you. Isn't it wajib?